Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You training to be a street cop?
I'm Sean Grogan. I'm the instructor for street cop training for unmasking hidden facial expressions and body language for law enforcement. I'm also the author of the book, Beware the Body. Eric.
Good to see you again, Sean.
Good to see you as well.
Thank you very much. And my name is Eric Baum. I'm the instructor for interview and interrogation for a street cop training. And I'm not an author, but it's a very, very good pleasure to be here today and sitting with you, Sean, to talk about an interest for both of us. And to me, I'm excited to be able to talk about this. So I know we agreed that I felt like I wanted to really pick your brain and start our dialogue here today. And you said that was fine. So how did you first develop an interest in unmasking facial expressions and body language?
When I was doing interviews, I felt like something was really missing. I'd been a bunch of the courses. You know, there's only so much that you pick up on the street or when you're speaking to someone inside the box, and it's just kind of, you're kind of thrown to the wolves, right? There isn't like, hey, we're going to go send you away for months as soon as you become a detective. So I started reading a bunch of psychology books to try to find out why people do what they do and say what they say. And one of the books I've read talked about Dr. Ekman, which you and I have talked about in the past, and these facial expressions that they found that there's these seven universal emotions that show up in the face. And I'm like, it's kind of interesting. Don't really do shit for me, right? I read on a little bit more today. They found out that you could use this stuff to assist in detecting deception. I was like, oh, light bulb went off on me. I'm like, I got to find this train. I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it for law enforcement. I found it for civilians, and it was very expensive, and it was over in Europe. So I was like, you know what? Let me get the facial action coding system they developed that let them figure out that these seven universal emotions, and it's for researchers, psychological. I'm not a psychological researcher. We look at it, I'm like, what am I going to do with this? So I started getting some of the books. There's only so much you learn in a book, right? So then I was like, you know what? Let me take the jump. Let me look into spending the big money going and getting this facial expression training. And not only did I got licensed to bring this stuff back. And once you start opening your eyes to observing body language, you just want to keep going. I mean, you pick up more stuff when you're dealing with people. Then I went further training, got certified in Virginia and things like that.
I think that's phenomenal. You must have been coming from your police department, which was what department?
So. Woodbridge. Yeah, I was at Woodbridge with Dennis.
You must have been the only one that took a vested interest to this extreme level with this. Because I've never, you know, coming from where I came from, never heard about a patrol officer or a detective from a local municipality taking such a keen interest in that type of training. So you might have been the only one.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's funny because you go to classes and, oh, did your agency send you for this? How'd you get your agency to pay for it? I go, no, my man. I paid myself. You know, you pay your own. Well, the credit card did. It was expensive training. You're looking at 10,000 plus, and you're looking at the time invested just to go to Europe for the training, not even what I did in Virginia. And, you know, you got travel expenses, everything else. It's very, very expensive training. You got people from around the world. Usually a company would send somebody.
Sure.
You got the U.S. military were sending interrogators over there. It was,
And you got to, I can assume through the training, you got to meet some very well-recognized individuals. I would say more on the federal level.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You already know who I'm probably thinking about.
Oh, you're talking about Joe Navarro. I was a mentor for his body language program with civilians around the world. So we actually started doing things during COVID. So I only met him through Zooms.
We were just Zooming each other. Tell everybody who Joe Navarro is.
Oh, if you
they Google him, they're gonna come up with tons.
There's a lot. Yeah, Joe Navarro's probably the most foremost expert on body language in the world. If you read a body language book, most likely it was probably Joe Navarro's. He's well recognized. His program now has been recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. They get continuing credits and things like that for it.
I don't know if he was overseeing it, or I know he was part of the FBI's behavioral analysis unit, right down in Quantico, which means some very, very big cases nationally came across his desk where he would help analyze interviews done with suspects and help form an opinion.
Yeah, he's got one book out. He's got a bunch of books out, but one of the books he wrote was, it's something to Doomsday. If you look it up, Joe Navarro Doomsday, you'll find a book. And he talks about how they got contacted. He was out of Tampa and they needed him to go speak with somebody in a trailer park home who was a chain smoker, and they brought up this guy's name, and it was the zigzag from cigarette smoke, these little things that we don't pay attention to. You get a chain smoke, boom, boom, boom. He's like, that's interesting. So I don't know the guy, I don't know who that is. And then he asked a couple more times and it kept happening, and from that there's something here. And it ended up being one of the largest breaches of data in U.S. history at the time. I mean, isn't that crazy?
Yeah, and he, he really is well recognized. And I mean, sharing with the audience, I like to play poker. Joe Navarro got himself involved in assisting poker players with what they would call poker tells. Yeah. I'm not going to say whether it's worked for me or not, but it is something that was interesting. I asked you earlier with respect to that training, and we were talking before we were recording. Did you have any scenarios or instances while in the performance of your duties where I said something wasn't sitting right? You had that gut feeling, your hairs on the back of your neck were standing up, where you were having an interaction with somebody and you somewhat wish you knew then what you know now with respect to your training in this aspect?
Oh, yeah. There's a few times. When you think back, you're like, I wish I started observing body language. And one of the major things as an indicator of something might be off is that erratic pacing. You got someone pacing no particular direction. Why are we letting them move around? And when you're a new officer, you might be like, oh, well, they're just kind of in this area. Well, why are they continuously, these erratic steps, moving forward, backwards, to the side? Are they already thinking about trying to get to something? Are they thinking about running? And there were a couple times where there were illegal guns in a car where I had that pacing and you're like, wow, I should have cuffed them right then and there. And there's one I'd mentioned before, the guy was paced around, moving, started going towards the car. I put the dog was in the car. I started going towards the guy to cuff him. The other officer was like, hey, I'm going to give you one more chance. Go sit back down. Of course, they find the gun. The guy takes off running, hopping fences. I mean, he had prison muscle, just straight out of prison. I think he was out for a few weeks or something like that. And he went right back in. But there's another time with Dennis as well. Dennis had someone, it was either a stop or a suspicious vehicle. They were off to the side. And I'm dealing with this dude, again, prison muscle, my size. I was in better shape at the time. I was younger, right? But the guy's moving around. And I'm like, he started going around the car towards the passenger door. And I was like, yo, my man, where are you going? I was still wet behind the ears. I was newer. And he's like, oh, I was just trying to fix something. There was some stuff on the back of the trunk. He goes, oh, I wanted the computer, I was afraid was going to fall over. For those of you in other states, we don't get a lot of earthquakes in New Jersey. I don't think that was going to fall over, right? But then Dennis had already ran this guy. I didn't know him. My job was to watch him, and I did. But I should have cuffed him, right? You're pacing around. Why didn't I cuff him? I could do that for my safety and his. We moving around. Turned out there was a loaded stolen 357 underneath the passenger seat. What do you think he was trying to go for? Like I said, it was my size, but prison muscle. It would have been a good fight. And if he got to it, it would have been a fucking bad day.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been an equal fight at that point. Yeah. Especially if he got his hands on it. And that's why, Sean, I said when we first agreed to start to do this, that I thought it was really good and exciting for me to hear from you about how this can really, truly, possibly save a police officer's life just by recognizing and understanding someone's behavior when you're having an interaction with them. Yeah. Because you just never know at what point something can go and flip. Yeah. So to me, I was totally intrigued by just the subject when I first joined Street Cop and started to see some of the different classes that was there. Not that all of the classes aren't phenomenal in their own ways to provide training, but for me, on a more personal level, because of what I do, you know, yours was like one that sort of stood out and be like, wow, that's great. Somebody else that's actually into behavioral mm-hmm. analysis. You know, I've always been a believer that when people would ask me, well, you know, Eric, how do you know if somebody's lying? How do you not know? And I said, I could give you a whole slew of different indicators. I go, but ultimately, you know, I have to trust my gut instinct too, that's yeah. something here is just not sitting right. You know, something the person did, something the person said, maybe a combination of what the person did and said at the same time. And I know that we said we were going to go back and forth and how my topic correlates with yours is, as a detective that worked for a prosecutor's office, even though I had the opportunity to do narcotics investigations and street crimes investigations throughout my career, the majority of my career was working in the sex crimes and child abuse unit and also as a polygraph examiner. And I got to go to polygraph school. We were talking about that. And I came back and I was just doing nothing but lie detector tests for my office. And we have in Bergen County many police departments. I had many friends in those police departments. So I did many, many polygraph examinations. But what the general public in law enforcement may not know is how polygraph training correlates with your training, because I had training that had to do fully with understanding human physiology. And one of the things that I took an interest in, Sean, was, okay, I know that people are going to lie to me.
Yeah.
I know that they have their reasons why they're going to lie to me, because they have fear of the consequences if the truth comes out. And one of the things that people should know is what a lie detector test or a polygraph examination is ultimately based upon is the recording of a person's physiological activities that occur during that exam when they are asked a question that they know they're going to lie to. And how I was trained with this is understanding what is called the fight, flight, or freeze response. And you understanding behavioral language and unmasking facial expressions, the understanding is that the body wants to have what's called homeostasis.
Yeah.
Just what we, the easiest term for homeostasis is the body just wants to be at norm, right? Have equilibrium within itself. But when you add an external factor from the outside that changes that homeostasis, that's what causes these physiological activities to present themselves. So with your training, did you have anything that was taught to you about why these actions were happening?
Yeah, the sympathetic nervous system, you know, like you said, freeze, fight, flight. I'm actually curious, because you bring up the polygraph when you're trained, because we know it measures physiological response. What are the actual responses? Like what, blood pressure?
What's recording during a lie detector test is a person's respiratory activity, basically mm-hmm. their breathing activity. We utilize a cardiograph. It's the same thing as when you go to the doctor and you get your blood pressure taken. What I'm recording is what is their blood volume in the cardiograph, and I'm recording their sweat gland activity. It's called galvanic skin response. Technical term. I put two small steel plates on the person's two fingertips, and it records their sweat gland activity. And the basis for how this works is this, Sean, so people have an understanding. Every question that I ask on a lie detector test is reviewed with the individual ahead of time. They know what I'm going to ask them. So if it's a theft case, if it's a robbery case, if it's an assault case, if it's a sexual assault case, a murder case, I'm going to ask the most simple question that requires nothing more than a yes or no answer. Did you stab so-and-so? When I review that question with the person in advance, and I say, this is the question I'm going to ask you. Did you do it? Yes or no? What's your answer? They say, no. I says, okay, that's the exact question I'm going to ask you on the test. When the test starts, in that person's mind, if they are what I call FOS, full of shit, they already know that they are going to lie to me, right? They know I'm going to lie to this guy. What happens is when I start to ask that question, that person's fight, flight, or freeze response activates, saying, I know I'm going to lie. I have a fear internally that my lie is going to show up on the lie detector test. Therefore, they cannot stop that internal fear, that sympathetic nervous system response from occurring inside their body. And that's how we actually monitor and record a lie detector test. And that's what I'm looking for, the responses to the person's lie. And the way I even explain it to someone that would take in the exam, I says, here's how I'm going to put this in perspective for you. Doesn't matter, I'm a police officer, you're a police officer, retired. You're driving down the road. All of a sudden, you see a police car come behind you. How does your body feel? And everybody would describe it. They're like, oh, my heart starts to go a little bit. I go, even if you're doing nothing wrong, you just see the police officer behind you. You get that nervous reaction, right? We'll take it a step further. Then the police officer pulls to the side and passes you. What happens to your body then? Your body starts to go back down to that homeostasis level. Well, that's exactly what I look for in a lie detector test, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
It's what I would consider to be a phenomenal tool to be utilized in law enforcement. It should never, ever replace an investigation. And as I teach in my class, Sean, I never once did a single lie detector test where an individual lied to me, was deceptive. And the moment that I told them what the results of the lie detector test were, they said, okay, you got me. Not once.
Really?
Not once. So ultimately, what I had to do is what I teach, interrogation. Yeah. I still had to interrogate the person and the polygraph, the results of the lie detector test. First off, they're never admissible in court. I can't use the results of the test in court. The only thing I could use is that admission. So learning that behavior as to like why things happen inside the human body, I took a real good interest in. However, I was never able to really utilize it like, you know, you were, or other patrol officers that may take your training really could use it, because what I was doing was always what would be considered reactive, right? An investigation, a crime happened, a suspect is developed, call Eric, all right? We have the suspect, if any, you know, let's take a shot. But for patrol officers, I mean, explain the benefit, how that could be such a benefit, because I never had that opportunity.
Yeah, with body language, we talk about using it to assist in detecting deception. And also, like we just talked about, the erratic pacing and a whole bunch of other movements in detecting aggression. You know, we talk about interviews. I think you're interviewing everybody. I know you said, you know, for a patrol, but you show up to the Lawn Gnome, missing Lawn Gnome house. You're not going there to go have a conversation, hang out with whoever called. You're there interviewing. Okay, well, what is this? What is that? And every time you talk to somebody as a cop, for not everybody, you're not walking in the 7-Eleven interviewing the guy behind the counter, but for the most part, anyone you're talking to, you're interviewing. And you're looking for the responses, and you're just gauging how people are moving. And it's one of those things where, how often are we thinking you're interviewing somebody? And this happens to all of us. We go, okay, I'm listening to what they said. What am I going to ask next? But I'm not paying attention to the changes that occur right in front of me, right?
Like, what an excellent point.
And let me ask you a with the polygraph. Are you familiar now with the voice analyzers that people
voice are stress using? Analyzer?
Yeah.
So when I went to polygraph school, VSA, it was referred to, voice stress analyzer, was just starting to present itself. And the world of polygraph was completely against it. I mean, they just said, no.
Oh, really?
We're not going to recognize it in any way. And that is the way it's maintained when I was still doing polygraphs up to the point of my retirement. So I can't even tell you now whether or not they've accepted it a little bit more or not. My feeling is probably no. Yeah. Polygraph examiners and those that have been trained in polygraph, you know, have their own unique mentality about, you know, we believe in what we're doing. And one of the things that we're taught, one of the utmost things that we were taught is ethics and you know, always maintain your ethics and what you're doing with respect to this. And I understood the principles of polygraph, saying, all right, I get the basic principles of the physiology as to what could happen. Now, people say, well, can somebody beat the polygraph? Can't they do it? Yeah, I mean, you know, it is always possible. Yeah. And that is why the results of a polygraph alone cannot be used in a court. You know, it's not considered an exact science that met that standard that exists, the scientific standard to be used, like DNA and fingerprints. Mm. It probably never will, but it's a tool.
And that's the thing. I've had a bunch of the polygraph examiners from different agencies, Secret Service, local, state, and they always say it's only as good as the interviewer themselves, the examiner themselves.
That is absolutely
that's
right. The results and the end results is only as good as the examiner is. But what's funny, as we're talking about this, we used to do, when I first started doing polygraphs, we were doing it at the courthouse. Courthouse is an older building that's been around for a long, long time in Hackensack. And the prosecutor's office was located within the courthouse there. And the polygraph room was down a hall. So it was probably a good 25, 30 foot walk. And as I started to do more and more of these, I used to wait in front of the entrance to the polygraph room and just sort of peek out and watch the person as they were being led down to the exam. And I would watch their body language. And you could just tell sometimes, a lot of times, some were good, some were bad. And then I'd put them in the room. And we had a, you know, one-way mirror. So I could look in, but they couldn't see out. And I would sit them in the chair and just say, I'll be right with you. And I'd watch them sit in the chair for just a few seconds and just see what was going on. And, you know, the fidgeting, thing. I mean, I used to see people put their hands together and go like, and you could almost see them saying, oh, dear God, I hope I could fucking get over on this guy. You know, just simple things like that. But that's why I took a real good vested interest in behavioral analysis and something that you said just before, and I actually have a slide in my presentation, and it says exactly this: behavioral analysis can be applied in any situation involving a law enforcement officer and another person. If you listen to what's being said and you observe the person, you will hear it and you will see it. But we also know that a lot of police officers may not take the time to put an effort into what you're teaching. I mean, I don't know how you could stress it enough that this is something that could ultimately be integral.
It's something, like I said, being able to use it to detect aggression, huge. Because that's really, at the end of the day, yeah, we want to catch people lying. We have people admit things. We want to go home safe more than anything. And the using it, I say assisting in detecting deception, because you know as well as I do, there's no A plus B equals C. No bullshit. this guy right here goes to Europe thinking, oh, I'm going to learn the systematic pattern of how people lie. And I pretty much thought, I'm like, what the fuck? I'm like, where's the pattern? Where's the A, you know, where's the 2 + 2 = 4? And but it don't exist. And so and that's one of the major things. There's no like reliable indicators of deception. There's something, okay, something's off here, red flags, and that's how I'm gonna and my questions, you know, are gonna get changed because I noticed something when I brought something up, or I need to keep probing a question because when this behavior occurred. But it's one of those things I really went over there going, yeah, I'm gonna learn. They've got some system probably that I'm gonna learn when people are lying that don't fucking exist. You know, it's a tool. It's a tool like anything else.
Have you, well, let me ask you this, I'm hopeful and certain that you have, with all the years that you've been doing this training, have you gotten feedback from officers that said that?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me.
Yeah.
I'm real curious.
I get a lot of good feedback about usually proactive stops where they get called somewhere and end up being a gun there. And they, hey, I noticed the blading. I noticed this. You know, I get sent videos too that I don't get sent. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, hey, look, this is what I noticed. This is why I took this step. The dude had a knife there. He started blading. I saw him look over the shoulder and I was like, don't even think about it. And, you know, it's one of those things to, it's preventative. And then I also, how many times are you jumping on things? You don't know how it would have turned out. You get someone foreshadowing their movements, so they started getting up the curb, but you already stopped them. You interrupted their OODA loop. But yeah, I get a lot of good feedback, and it's usually, hey, especially with the videos, don't mention my name if you want to use this testimonial. You know, I saw this, or hey, this video never got sent to you. Hey, watch this video here. And some of the videos are like hilarious where you're like, oh yeah, like that's it. And that's one of those things, if you weren't looking, you'd miss it. You know, if you're just looking down at your notepad, but if you're actually looking at the person, hey, do you have this in the car? Do you have that? Do you have that? And then it's like, there'll be a change in the behavior, rapid blinking at one point. It'll be like, hey, do you have drugs in the car? Or do you have cocaine in the car? No. Do you have heroin in the car? No. Do you have large quantities of money in the car? No. You know, they change that. Yeah. They're going up and down when you've been going left to right. And in our culture, this is an affirmation. This is a negation.
Correct.
Not for every culture, like the Bulgarians, there's other cultures that do different things. But for us, why did you, and just the changing. Now, if you went like this each time, maybe you were just emphasizing the no. But, you know, those things that, it's, like I said, I get the sent the things that, you know, not today, IA, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't see get rid of it.
No, that's good. And you must, just going through seeing videos of, law enforcement's interactions with suspects where they turn bad, where you probably have seen indicators that were probably like, oh, yeah, you know, that's unfortunate that the officer missed it or didn't. But I guess what it comes down to, Sean, is that no interaction with somebody should be just taken for granted.
No.
If you think about sometimes when a law enforcement officer responds to take a report on something and you just treat it nonchalant and all of a sudden, you know, you went from 0 to 10 just like that and you weren't prepared for it. I mean, I was always a believer that I'm going to be prepared for the worst and hope for the best.
Yeah.
And with the things that I was able to do in my career. And, you know, like I tell everybody, when people take my class and they see my background, they're like, all right, you know what, this guy was, you know, all this guy did was take training and interview and interrogation. He was never a real cop. Well, I tell her straight up, that's fucking bullshit. Because I started as a narc. I got to do a lot of good shit. And where Bergen County was located with New York City, Tuareg, Patterson, Newark, I was in all those jurisdictions doing a lot of exciting things. Fights, been there. Car chases, been there. Foot pursuits, been there. Getting punched in the face, been there. All right, so it wasn't just me sitting in a room with somebody. And there were times where I do, when I reflect back early in my career, where I wish I had like the type of training that you're providing, because I reflect back and think, you know what? You fucking missed it, Eric. The guy was gonna run. You should have been able to prevent that.
Yeah, that's, and like you said, it's one of those things. And I'll be in classes during breaks. You know, what you talked, I had one guy that was in a shooting. It was in a shooting like 2-3 days before. I won't mention the agency, but I knew there was a shooting in the agency. So I go to the guy, I go, hey, how's the guy doing that got shot? And he goes, oh, you know, he's doing all right. He's, you know, he gave me the rundown. He goes, I was actually the other officer that was there. I go, get out. He goes, dude. And then he comes up to me. And he goes, you know, I saw this behavior, that behavior right before. It was kind of choked. I mean, the guy had just been in shooting a couple of days before. It was like, you know, I'm going there, like thinking I'd ask. It was a larger, you know, one of the larger cities in the country. And I figured, oh, I'd ask, hey, how's the guy doing? And they end up being one of the cops in the shooting, you know, and it's one of, and it's not just that time. It's a whole bunch of, when you learn, how did I remember this at that time. I remember seeing this. I should have done that. It's to be able to articulate it to yourself, right? We talked about this before. We have the hairs on the back of our neck stand up. But then when you're not able to articulate to yourself, you're like, especially today, people are afraid because of the lawsuits and everything else and anti-police sentiment. And we've all got lawsuits going on and still got lawsuits myself, just like everybody else out there. And it's like, you don't want to be hesitant. That's a problem. You know, and
I think you hit a very valid point on, because I still have a great deal of friends that are still active law enforcement. Yeah. I hear that same sentiment about, you know, how hard it is to do your job. And it's sad. And I actually, I'm not going to get into the whole thing. I actually posted something on our Street Cop Facebook site about, you know, when officers responding to calls and whether they still, you know, feel the enthusiasm for it or not. I couldn't believe some of the responses that I was getting back about, well, you don't know unless you've had IAs and this and that. And I go, and I'm like, and I spoke to Captain Rizzo about it. And I says, Tom, look at some of these responses. I go, what has happened? You know, because I have the same, I have the same advice that I give to every friend that's in law enforcement. If you don't feel it inside that you could still do it, then get out before you get hurt or somebody else gets hurt. And I understand it's tough, but like you just said, you can't be afraid to do your job. If you can articulate it the way I think you just said it, why you felt the need to maybe take one step higher to prevent yourself or somebody from getting hurt, then articulate it and do it. You know, we were taught, you know, both of us are Jersey trained through academies where we were taught that we're permitted to meet force that comes at us with equal force and then one higher. Now, I've always been a believer that saying is like, listen, if I see that force coming at me, if I could de-escalate, I'm going to do everything within my power to de-escalate the person and tell the person, look, I could see how you're feeling. Take a deep breath. Think before you do something, because you won't win in the end. And, you know, we could work together. And I would just lower my voice and I would be calm. And I'd be like, please, you know, I'd even say, like, please don't do something that's going to make this worse. I go, you could end up cooperating now. And maybe this can all work out in the end. And just, and all of a sudden you'd see they might start to de-escalate. But if they didn't, they didn't. You know, what can you do?
It's funny you said that. You must be reading my mind, because that's exactly what I was going to bring up about that. In the academy, I was taught the same thing. You're allowed to meet or go up, but I don't know what they're going over now. You know, I don't know.
I think it's still the same. I mean,
I don't know.
I know there's a lot with de-escalation training that's going on these days. You know, talking to some of the street cop instructors about, you have to write reports, even if you almost like pull out your weapon for safety. I mean, it is what it is, but I'm, you know, I still believe to this day, and you know, whether, you know, the people that watch this or don't is that you have to go home. Yeah. You know, you have to go home at night to your loved ones. And if that means that you have to articulate it the right way, why you did what you did, then do it. Because coming from a prosecutor's office, I used to say, look,
My job is to do my job. The job of the assistant prosecutor is to go to court and show that what I did was justified. That was the way I felt.
Yeah.
I did what I did. I articulated it and memorialized it in my report. Now you go to court and you show that what I did was the right thing to do. Now, if you can't, then okay, I guess we got a problem.
A lot of it, I think, depends on where you're working as well.
And yes, but I wanted to flip back to something that we were talking about where we were trying to say how what you do and what I do like can correlate. So for the people that are listening, it's great to know that this person is showing all those indicators of lying, being FOS, deception. It's great to know it, but how do you prove it? And that's where the art of an interrogation comes in. Knowing that somebody is lying, but then getting that person to tell the truth. And that's why both our topics of instruction, you know, mesh together so much, because like I said, I've never once did a lie detector test where the person was lying. And I could tell you, Sean, I knew they were lying within the first few minutes of just sitting down with the person. But ethically, I had to go through the whole thing. And guess what? Do the exam, do the whole thing. Tell the person, I'm sorry, the results of your lie detector test show that you have not been truthful with me here today. And then here comes Eric Baum interrogation 101. You know, have you been able to use what you've learned to lead it to something down the line in terms of an investigation? Or do you see how it could be like on field interviews where you sense somebody is not being honest with you and maybe being able to take it to the next level?
Oh yeah.
Like, do you go over that at all? Like,
I go over the behaviors. I don't go so much into what you do as far as the interviewing. Mm-hmm. I go over how you would use it when you realize something's wrong. You would change your, not change, but you would steer your interrogation or interview down that angle.
Excellent.
I picked up on a red flag here. I brought this up. I started seeing behaviors. They started grabbing their neck once. And we're looking for groupings and clusters, right? And then they do it again when I bring up that same topic. Well, now I got to ask a lot more questions about that topic. And there's no, at the end of the day, I'm not going to be like, well, the person did the hokey pokey, so they must be lying to me. We look for verifiable facts.
Sure.
And confessions. I ask you, where were you 2 o'clock on this day? Oh, I was at work. Oh, okay, you were at work. But when you do that, you have a rapid nose inhale before you answer. All right, we start talking some more. Hey, where'd you say you were again at that time? I was at work. You got grabbed in the neck or some other behavior. Maybe the blink rate goes up. You're like, okay, well, something's going on there. So I want to know the verifiable facts. What am I going to do afterwards? I'm either going to go myself to where they work or send somebody else and say, hey, do you mind if I look at your logs of who signed in that day? And they'll be like, yeah, fuck you, pig. And I'm like, no, now I'm going to get a subpoena. I'm on overtime. Who cares? Thank you. Right? We win either way. So we're looking for those verifiable facts. And as well as, you know, confessions. You said with the polygraph, it's not, and the polygraph interests me because, as you know, in New Jersey, they can't compel you as an employer. So it's one of those things. And around the country, they're using polygraphs to hire and IA investigations. And it always interests me.
Like, I've had some people that have taken pre-employment polygraphs for law enforcement jobs and would ask me some advice, and I gave, I ethically, I did not disclose anything about like how a lie detector test works. So my first response would always be is like, just tell the truth.
Yeah.
If you're going to lie, then don't take the exam. Just don't. One person was taking a lie detector test for pre-employment got very nervous and worked up. Do what I told him. I said, listen, this is how a polygraph is. I go, they're going to review the questions. They're going to do that. I go, and the person told me that they came back. The results of the polygraph, showed that they were inconclusive. There's three results. You get deception indicated, means you're lying. No deception indicated, you're truthful. Inconclusive means the examiner couldn't render a full opinion one way or the other. And I told the person, I go, listen, I go, based on what you're telling me, I go, I just think you overthought it. And that's one of the problems with people and polygraph is that there always is going to be a nervousness when people interact with law enforcement. I mean, there's always going to be it doesn't even have to be a polygraph. You know, the most people, they get nervous when they interact with law enforcement. And that's why, as you said, it's up to it would be up to me as the examiner to understand that nervousness exists, but to do everything within my power to make the person less nervous, to show that they're being honest. You know, which is almost something that you could say is, listen, I know you might be nervous. You've never been pulled over before. I mean, some people, believe it or not, hey, have never been pulled over by the police before.
It's crazy.
But the first time they do, they might be nervous as shit.
Oh yeah.
So as law enforcement officer, like, you have to be able, I guess, to gauge.
Yeah, like you said, and getting pulled over by everyone shaking. License registration, so,
yeah.
Well, why? It's not because they're lying to you about where they're coming from when you ask them. It's because they don't want a ticket. They don't want to have the insurance go up. They don't want to pay the $80. They don't, and your authority anyway. They're but you're looking for that settling down. And that's, even if they're nervous the whole time, could be their baseline behavior. It's just what they do.
But which goes back to something that you said about, if I notice that nervousness, I might want to ask a couple questions and see what direction, you know, it goes in. If the person says, listen, I've never been pulled over before, you know, so I'm sorry, I'm scared, you know, I'm there. Okay.
It makes sense. And I was never a ticket writer. If you weren't getting arrested for something, you weren't getting a ticket. Like, what tickets? So if I stop somebody, and as soon as you go, hey, listen, I'm not a ticket writer, but I got to stop cars, you know, this and that. Let me show you why I stopped you, you know. And then I've already told you you're not going to take. Usually people call me, hey, listen, you were going whatever, your taillights out, this and that. And okay, nothing's wrong here. Go to our see you later. You know, it's one of those.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it wasn't.
I know you've probably asked it all the time. You know, I'm asked it not as frequently as probably you are, but when people say, okay, Sean, what's your favorite?
Oh, yeah.
What's your favorite indicator that the person is full of shit?
And that's something I do get asked all the time. I like shoulder shrugs. I like rapid nose inhales.
Show me a shoulder shrug.
It could be both or it could be one.
But just like just the one. Just like this.
Yeah. No, I'm not talking about they're attracted, but people also raise their shoulders when they're excited too, right? Like it's a restrained excitement. So it's, you know, we don't throw our hands up in the air anymore like when we're kids, like, oh, we're going to the park. We don't go, wow, we're going to the bar. We're going to the bar. We're going to play poker. No, we don't do that. We're like, oh, yeah, we're going to go over there. And you're excited. But also there's that uncertainty. And they found that in many cultures. There's a little debate about whether it's universal throughout. But many cultures around the world, you get that shoulder shrug. So you get someone that pops the one shoulder. If I ask you directly, Eric, what do you think about Johnny? And you go, yeah, I like Johnny a lot. That's interesting. Where's the uncertainty? Do you not understand the question? Do you not know how to answer? Do you not really know Johnny? Do you not know how to tell me you fucking hate Johnny? There's something there and I want to ask more questions.
That's interesting. Yeah. So shoulder shrug, what's your top three, would you say?
I would say shoulder shrugs, rapid nose inhale, and grabbing of the neck. But also, I like the blink rate change. Okay. Because when you get that blink rate really going, there's several reasons that could occur that they found. It's, you know, the average blink rate they say is 16 to 20 times a minute in one study and other ones is other. Are you out there counting blinks? No, you're not counting blinks. But I'm going to look. If I have that rapid blink off the bat, I'm trying to build rapport. It comes down. And then when people concentrate, it'll also slow down.
And that nose, that inhalation, is that before answering the question?
Before answering a question, also hearing something when people don't like will very often do it. People, like, yeah, like, okay. You've done it a couple times since we've been talking, but that's something that you do. It's your baseline behavior, so I'm not going to take too much note of it.
Plus my horrible sinuses.
Yeah, see, but I take note of that, and sure. I noted you've done it at just inopportune times means nothing. It's your baseline behavior. You have sinus issues, and yes, people have sinus issues. They have colds. They have allergies. Hey, so I noticed that. However, if I've been talking to you for a while, and we hit on a topic, and...
And it's just
after I say something you don't like or before you speak.
So that's a phenomenal point because one of the things that I direct my students to understand is to look for timing and consistency of the behavior with relation to the topic at hand. Meaning, if you and I are just sitting down, Sean, and I'm going to be establishing rapport with you, getting your pedigree information, just starting, and it's a non-threatening dialogue, right? Just starting out. But then we start to get into the issue at hand, right?
Yep.
The issue with him. And then I start asking you a question, and I see, you know, that behavior where, you know, like something, anything.
Yeah.
You know, where I'm like, wait a minute. All right. I wasn't seeing that while we were talking about something non-threatening to the person, but I'm seeing it as we're talking about something that's making the person uncomfortable. So that's a great point that you brought up. So when people ask me, I says, okay, well, one of the things that I first do is when I meet somebody for the first time, you know, if I know that I'm going to be conducting that interview and I know it's a suspect, I'm doing it for another department, whatever. I look for how the person is sitting because they're seated. Remember, you know, with you in law enforcement interactions out on the road, a lot of times, you know, the person is sitting in the car where they are constrained in the car where there's not a whole lot of movement they could really be doing that's visible to you.
Yep.
But me and the setup that I set up the room is I'm going to be able to see everything. So I'm looking, you know, to see how the person is sitting. I said, the first thing I do when I walk in and I meet somebody and I see somebody with their arms folded, you know, and crossed like this, I know that this person is uncomfortable because we were taught that, you know, that means they're protecting their innards, so to speak. And when I start to talk about a topic that may be uncomfortable to the person, and I just look for those little things like, all right, we used to have a polygraph chair. It was cotton on the armrests.
Okay.
It was cotton because we had to have the person's arms sitting flat like this. All right. The cardiograph, the sweat gland plates that were put on. So we had there. And then when it started to get into it, you know, I used to see people, the cotton on both the armrests was like almost completely, we had to get a new chair. Why? Because of the people.
Picking at it.
Picking. Picking the lint, you know, you know, looking down, looking away, just little things. And I'd be like,
what's your big one? What did you like the most behavior-wise?
I'll start by saying I am sort of a neurolinguistic guy with eye movement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I know it's not conducive for everybody.
Yeah.
But when I'm talking to somebody, if I just see, you know, somebody's eyes, you know, going up, down, left, down, right, that's one of the first things. The other thing is hand movements, leg tapping a little bit. But again, I look for it in a cluster, Sean. I don't look for just one behavior. Yeah. I look for like small clusters. So if I ask a question and I see, just like you said, and if I see somebody say, yeah, you know, or just like this, you know, maybe sometimes I see them covering their mouth when they're answering because they know they're fucking full of shit, you know, little head moon. And one of the things that I like is I like when people put their hands together. Remember we talked about that one before, you know, like not just like, but like almost sometimes like a
prank, but over the genital region.
Yeah. What's your thoughts on that one?
Well, covering the genital area. Think about it. When in public, for the most part, we don't have our hands in our genitals, right? You might sit at home with your hands down your pants. People do that. It's what it is. But we know display rules, how we're supposed to act in our culture. It's not something we do. So that covering up, when did that occur? Why? If you watch Alex Rodriguez in a 60 Minutes interview with Katie Couric, highest paid baseball player in the fucking world. Right? Got all this money. He goes, takes this interview. He's sitting there like a little kid with his hands over there. And there's a whole lot of other behaviors there. I actually showed that one in the class. That's a pretty good one with some of the.
I'm gonna have to watch that one.
Yeah, I'll show you. I have that one. It's pretty good. But that, you know, that's, the covering. It's,
yeah. I like you said, there's no one universal indicator. And I preface that by saying, listen, just because you may see this behavior, it doesn't necessarily mean. I go, what I teach is I go, use these indicators as guides to help you form the opinion. I go, depending on the case, whatever the case investigation may be, if I have a live victim, if I have evidence, if I have something that basically shows that the person is responsible for committing the crime, but We still want that person's confession for it. The behavior is not going to be such a contributing factor to me because I'm already set in my goal that I don't care what you do. I don't give a shit what you're doing in this chair. I'm getting the confession. I want the truth from that person.
Yeah.
So all the behavior in the world doesn't mean shit if I can't get the person to ultimately tell me the truth about what it is that I'm talking to them about. But I also need guidelines. I need a direction at times with my interviews. It's saying something is wrong, you know? I mean, I when we talk about statement analysis also, which I've taken some statement analysis classes. I was talking to one guy at one point. It was a pretty long interrogation, and the person said, "Well, I'm trying to be honest with you." And I said, so I sat back in my seat, and the key word being
trying.
What does a truthful person say?
I'm being honest with you. Yeah, and those are the things, if you pick up, like what we were showing before, like the video, like there's those things people miss, right? The statement of, like, you're just not, if you're not listening, you got to put it all together. It's no, they're all tools.
Absolutely.
And someone could just say that, but, you know, that's a huge red flag, right? Curiosity, tickler, whatever you want to call it. I got more questions.
I love that. And, you know, when I was a supervisor and a lieutenant, I would watch my detectives in sex crimes doing their interviews and interrogations, you know, they never really felt comfortable with me watching because they knew that if they didn't get it, I was always going to be there to come in. But I would, you know, I always say, give it your best effort. I go, if you don't get the confession, I go, don't beat yourself up. I go, you will, you know, you're going to get, it's going to happen, you know? And if I walk in and then like 5 minutes later, the person could be, they're like, well, how the fuck did you do that? I'm like, don't go by me. Don't go by me, because I'm going to scramble your brain in that interrogation room as best as I can, that you're going to just have absolutely no choice but to just tell me the truth. I mean, that's the mentality that I try to do it. If I'm not certain, Sean, if I'm not sure, and the only thing I have to go on is behavior, well, I got to go on the behavior before I make that decision. And that's one of the things that I teach. It's like, look, I ask something that's called baiting questions. I don't know if you've ever heard of a baiting question. A baiting question is like where, let's say I'm just a little uncertain and I'd be like, so let me ask something. Is there any reason why all of a sudden you see somebody that would be really good and all of a sudden, is there any reason why someone would say that they saw you? And then they'll say, but what? Why? Did somebody say they saw me? Boom. Thank you for that indicator.
Yeah. Any reason why your fingerprints were on this gun?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, those to me are great, but most patrol officers are going to have interactions with people on a daily basis. They're not going to be doing it in the context of the setting that I do it in
the box,
in the room there, you know. And if it's an interrogation, have it electronically recorded and so on and so forth, going through Miranda and everything. So to me, I mean, I stress it that what you teach could have a real lasting impact on police officers out there. You never know what it could lead to. I mean, it could be the most simplistic Q&A, and all of a sudden something happens. And boom, you're finding weapons in the car. Wow. You're finding coke in the car, heroin, whatever it may be. Wow. I mean, that's the stories that I hope that you would hear.
Yeah, I get that. And I get a lot of the ones to detecting aggression. Like I say, oh, there's a weapon that we're moving this way, so a blade in the body, end up being a gun here. The one dumped a gun underneath the car, kept on moving around. And the one I always like are the preventative. Hey, I ended up snatching him up. He did have a knife on his one side there. I saw him looking down there, started blading. You know, it's one of because it's you don't know where that would have turned, right? You just don't. And we can get statistics. Oh, how is this working? You're never really going to know. That person that you jumped on, not jumped physically, but they started, you know, still got lawsuits going on. You got someone that stands up, starts to stand up on a curb, and you're like, don't even fucking think about it. Don't think about it. And you interrupt their OODA loop. Well, where was that going to turn to? Did they have a gun in a car they were trying to get to? Were they going to run? You're going to have to run across a highway, which is, you know, we're like, oh, we just got to run after somebody. Well, you, when you're running, you get that tunnel vision. Oh. You don't, you know, you end up running across highways and stuff. Well, one guy, I remember I had to tackle in an off ramp. I remember thinking afterwards, because it was, you know, end up a short chase, gets out, one guy slips, and I'm tackling him. You know, my head afterwards, because the one guy's wife was actually sitting in the traffic behind us and takes a picture of us out there. And like, she's like, say, hey, what are you guys, like, craziness? Like, you never, you know, just can't believe it. One of the cops' wives, not one of the suspects. But you tackle this guy, my head's over the other part of the double yellow. If another car was coming, you know, and you just think... And, we're just like, yeah, it is what it is.
You're right. You're right.
Right?
I mean, there's no other way around it is that we as law enforcement, you know, and it's happened with me and it's happened with guys that I've worked with where our adrenaline does get the best of us.
Yeah.
But I know you had something video. Like,
so Diane Downs, for those of you that aren't familiar, in the 1980s out in Oregon, she took her three children, drove them out into the middle of nowhere, shot all three of them and shot herself in the arm. The youngest kid died. The other kid has been is paralyzed. He's not a kid anymore. And the older daughter, she was under 10 at the time, she survived. And for 9 months, she ran around taking television interviews and saying, hey, some bushy-haired man shot us. And it turned out that she actually shot him. And someone had called in and said, hey, that car that she was in, I remember that car. I had to drive around that car because it was going so slow. I couldn't believe how slow it was going on this county road. But she, of course, told the cops, I went to the hospital as fast as I could. But that's not enough probable cause for an arrest. So the daughter was going to see a psychologist. And the psychologist was pretty good. And after 9 months, was able to get her to say, yes, my mom. And the girl actually had to testify against her mom in court at that young age. Could you imagine? And then this piece of shit, she shows up pregnant with another, you know, pregnant. And she was trying to kill the kids because the boyfriend she had at the time didn't want children. So, and you watch her speak. We saw the video. You want to play the video?
Sure. Or, yeah. I think it's a good video just to see where she's, what really took me with her video, what stuck out to me was a complete lack of emotion.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't see any emotion here. Did you?
It's just, I see the possible duping delight, but that's it. There's no, it's the complete opposite of what you would expect. And like you said, it's very structured, right?
Yes.
We go for, it's not, you know, when we talk stuff, we forget things. We go back and forth. And then what you pointed out with the, you want to bring it up again, or you can bring it up after we play with the they, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that one, you know, like I said, when I hear something, I was like, oh, and you know what, Sean, I meant to, before we even showed it, I wanted to ask you, because what I'm taught and what I teach is I do not bring a person's nonverbal behavior to their attention that they're doing it. Why? Because I want the person to continue to do it.
Yeah.
If I tell the person, listen, I could tell, you know, I know you're not being honest, I know you're not being truthful because you're doing this, 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 and this. Well, what's the person not going to do for the rest of that interview? That,
yeah, they're going to stop.
And if I tell somebody the same thing with people, we talk about eye contact, right? And I know that, you know, for a lot of people, eye contact is like the biggest thing. And like, there are some cultures, as you know, you're very, I'll have you touch on that before we do this, about they don't look you in the eye. And I'll tell people, like, all right, listen, maybe the person's not looking you in the eye. That could be an indicator. But I've seen detectives who be like, well, fucking look me in the eye. And you know what? You know what the person's going to do the whole time now?
Yeah.
The death's there. I teach, don't bring those indicators to their attention. Now, out on the road or with what you teach, I mean, maybe it's different. Maybe it could be beneficial?
Depends on what it is. When it comes to detecting deception, I agree with you 100%. Why would you tell that person what they're doing and get them to stop? However, when it comes to aggression detection, if someone's blading their body or, you know, starting the firm digital flexion, yo, why are you clenching your fist, my man? You know what I mean? Well, get in their OODA loop. Same thing, like I said, someone trying to get up.
Could you explain? Because I've never heard that term before. Aggression
detection.
Yeah,
well, there's different indicators that people have very, very often before they attack someone.
Before they attack, okay.
Such as a look over the shoulder. We also get that when people take off on us, right? But it's usually a couple. Let me look. But people very often look either down or away or over the shoulder prior to attack. If you're looking at me and you're talking to me and I look away, what are you thinking? The person not even looking at me, they're not a threat right now. But I've already locked in on you, number one. Number two, the person that's doing it doesn't want you to see it coming. So they turn away, oh, and then man. I bow, I'm coming at you. Same thing with a pants lift. When do we see the pants lift? Before people run, but before we fight too. If you work in an agency where you get called in for, you know, hey, we got 30 people fighting in a club. And back in the day, we used to actually go and do what had to be done instead of just waiting until it all finished, whatever they do now. But you go there, you watch, cops will lift their pants up. Now, sometimes people lift their pants when they're falling. But duty belts, they'll lift the duty belts up. Everybody's lifting their duty belts up, getting ready to go. The duty belt ain't going nowhere. It's got the keepers on there. It ain't falling down. But people do this all the time before they fight. I show videos in class. You got two guys squaring up, both blading, and both lifting the pants at the same time. Because we do this to get ready to
Let me ask something. This woman she's out there.
Yeah.
Do you have a video of somebody doing that behavior before running or fighting?
The lifting of the pants?
Just what you were talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I tell you the truth, I'd rather see that. This is great, and we could tell the people her name is Susan Downs, and you could look that up.
Diane Downs, you're thinking Susan Smith.
Susan Smith, yeah. Diane Downs, and I mentioned Susan Smith, that's the woman I talk about in my class who drowned her two children. And I also talk a little bit about JonBenet Ramsey case too. You know, the most famous, what I would say is some of the most famous cases in the last 30 plus years. That's very interesting, Sean, for the police officers that are out there to see that, because I never, again, the behavior that I refer to with what I'm doing could be on a field interview, looking for those indicators of what the person is doing with the nonverbal behavior. But also I have to take it into the next step of sitting in the room with somebody when we're conducting a formal interview with a possible suspect of a crime and observing those physical indicators of deception. But being out on the road, you know, when you only have a split second to really sometimes pick up on this, you don't have a whole lot of time.
No. And there's a recent one that came out, I think within the last month or so, and several indicators. The looking over the shoulder, the guy was on, both of them were on the driver's side. He's standing kind of, the driver door's open. I don't know if you've seen it. The guy looks over his shoulder, slight pants lift in the front, and they end up teeing off on the cop. And it's one of those things, if you're looking, like you say, you don't have a whole lot of time, but sometimes you that second's all you need to be able to, oh, put my notepad away. You know what I mean? Like, why am I standing there going, oh, tell me more, Mr. Johnson. Tell me more, Mr. Smith. Like, no, like, let me put this down. I just saw a look over the shoulder like this. What are you looking over like that? Are you thinking about attacking me? You know, like, what? And like I said, I'm not going to call that out, but I would call out other things. Hey, why are you clenching your fists?
Is there any behavior that you were able to see while approaching a driver's side while approaching a car, whether it's from the driver's side? I know now it's passenger side approach, but being 90% blinded, approaching from the rear, was there anything that you would see?
You look for the shoulders dropping, because you know back in the day they were using that furtive movements.
Yes.
Right? You know what I'm talking about? And it's like, well, what
is furtive movement? Yeah.
What's a furtive movement?
I've seen that in my report a few times. Oh, my God, like, that is so funny. You just brought back a memory.
Like, what is the furtive movement? It's one of those.
Reaching. That's what we used to articulate.
But what exactly did you see? Did you see that shoulder drop down? Did you see a look over the shoulder? Especially the looking back to see if I'm coming. If I'm not, especially if I'm not, usually I would jump out of a car, especially narcotics. I wouldn't start calling things out. I wanted on that car first. So when I'm moving towards it, what are you looking for? It's not like you've been sitting there for 5 minutes. Why are you looking back to see where I'm coming from? You sit there, because if I get stopped and I was a cop. I'm still not going to be like, oh, where is this guy? Oh, no, I'm going to sit there. Okay, you come on. And everybody's different, right? But you see that look back, what's that about? What are they nervous for?
That's really interesting.
To that level. Because everybody, like we talked about before, you get that nervousness prior to you getting stopped. Shit, I don't want to get stopped, especially out of state. You know what I mean?
That's so funny that you brought back that furtive movement, because that's exactly what we utilized in memorializing in our reports. That, all right, well, why did you look in the passenger area, Eric? Because I saw the subject reach into that area. You know, I saw the subject bend forward. Now,
yeah, that's something you see video after video after video. And I can think back times where I saw it and I didn't even realize it at the time. The leaning over at the waist, right, with the hands down in this region here, people do this when they get up very often. So why would a person, especially when you get a steering wheel here, leaning over like this? You watch video after video or video with shootings or someone takes off and they're leaning over like this. Why are you leaning over? There's not a lot of room here. And the passenger as well. Same thing.
Real, real interesting fact, because as you know, the majority of a law enforcement patrol, when they are going to be doing an interview, you know, if it's a road stop, I mean, it's, you're getting out of your car and you're approaching. Yeah. Now, responding to a call is different when you're having that interaction with somebody. But if you're going to get somebody out of their car, if you know, these days you can get somebody, ask them to step out of the car for whatever their reasons. Yeah. I mean, you have to be aware of what you were witnessing, because that's what I said. When a cop just takes it for granted, don't, man, just don't. I mean, I think we both, you know, you have videos showing where the cop was approaching thinking everything was just fine and dandy. And just like that, I mean, the whole idea is we want to go home safe. I want to see every police officer go home safe. And I mean that.
And that, you said, you know, approaching situation. This cop here, this is in Massachusetts, at a police headquarters. And it appears there's a guy that's going to meet a cop over here, right? And it looks for the most part like he's getting food delivered. So if you go out into your lobby at your headquarters, are you thinking that someone's going to attack you the second you say, no, you're going to think, oh, I'm going to pick up my food, I'm going to meet somebody for this. And you have this other guy milling around over here. And you're going to see, he's milling around. As he's approaching, he does a look over the shoulder and ends up attacking the cop with a knife. See in that top right corner. The cop comes out.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He just stabbed him?
Yeah. And you saw about 4 or 5 steps prior, that look over the shoulder. Oh, you see that, like I said, it could be closing the distance, but also you got someone that's right in front of someone that'll look over the shoulder or down. And lifting the pants, I mean, you see this constantly. You know, this is just a couple of the indicators that
I mean,
go over the blade.
Wow. Yeah. Sean, that's...
And he was
approaching pretty rapidly. Why?
Why are you walking towards me like that when I'm getting food? You know, if you pay attention, you're trying, and I'm not saying anything about the cop. This happens.
Of course. I mean, that's how could he know?
Yeah, you go out into the lobby. You're like, oh, my food's here. I haven't eaten. You know, I'm working 12-hour shift. I've been in this interview. I got this. I got that. And the last thing you're thinking is there's going to be some fucking maniac in there that's going to want to stab
me. Wow.
No, this is a street fight. You watch both guys. At one point, the one guy's going to lift his pants up, and then the other guy will do the same. And you see, like I said, you'll see this constantly prior to fights. And we do the same thing when we think we're going to fight. I've showed up to domestics where you hear yelling, and then you got the other cop, you look over. They're coming up the same way, like lifting the pants up, getting ready in case you got a fight. One, two,
yep.
Right? Oh, and now you're like, okay.
Here we go.
Getting ready.
Again.
And then they go, and the little guy asks for it, and the little guy's going to get it.
Oh.
Yeah. Again, wow. These are things you'll see. If you watch videos after videos after videos, you'll see these behaviors occur all the time. Now, every time someone lifts their pants, are they going to be attacking you or running? No. Right? Like, you can't be like, oh, lift the pants, I'm going to go punch someone in the face. Because guess what? Pants fall. People adjust themselves.
What suggestions do you have for police out there that are unable to attend your class in the near future? What like material, suggestions, reading, viewing? Is there anything that you suggest?
I don't want to sell my own book here, my book has all that information. I've been told it's written pretty well, where you can picture, like, people have come to my class.
And the
like,
name of the book?
Beware the Body.
Beware
the Body. And it's also on audio if you're...
Beware the Body. Yeah. Is it being sold by, like, Barnes & Noble?
It's on Amazon.
It's on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. And you can get it on Audible, I think another Amazon type of thing. And there's another... I can't remember the third place it's on. But yeah, you can... You go on Amazon, you get whatever you need.
I buy
everything.
You can promote your own book. Why not?
You're
covering all the basics of
everything's in there.
Of what we were really talking about here. And in terms of like YouTube videos, I mean, I guess the only thing I could say is look, type in the words behavioral analysis, and you'll come up with some videos.
If you go on police activity, there's videos after videos after videos. Just observe. Get used to observing and seeing what you're seeing.
You know what? Are you able to pull up an email on here?
Yeah, I got YouTube as well. So if you want to send me an email,
see if that comes up. So I'm just going to say real quick that regardless of your opinion, my opinion is I've always been a fan of Michael Jackson as a musical artist, but. And there's a but, I say, I found this video where Michael Jackson was accused of being involved in possible child molestation. And he's never been convicted. He's never been, I think he was almost charged, but I'm not really sure. But ultimately, he was never convicted and so on and so forth. And I leave it at that. And I am not saying that Michael Jackson is guilty of child molestation. I saw this video. Something that I show briefly in my class, but I want to get your opinion about this also, Sean, and just see what you think about this with what you've seen.
Chandler, or his family on his behalf, filed a litigation, a lawsuit against you.
Yes.
To your knowledge, Mr. Jackson, were you ever accused of having sexually molested Brett Barnes?
We'll answer that.
Pause it. I'm sure you have.
We went over before this.
I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
The smiling. What are you smiling before? Is it possible duping delight? Like, what is that?
Explain that.
Duping delight, someone's lying to you. They think they're getting over on you, and they take pleasure in that. But it could also be what's known as narcissistic glee. Someone has a narcissistic personality, and they get that attention, and it could be negative attention, and they still like it. And it also could be a nervous smile. We know that. People smile and laugh and are nervous, but hey, huge red flag. You're getting accused of, hey, you're getting asked if you ever molested a kid. Like, what is that? Then we get that sinking down into the chair you went over. We get the covering of the face as well, which is pretty interesting. And we take note of it. I'm like, that's interesting. Why did this occur? And then he gets asked.
Go ahead.
He gets asked about the, what was his name? Macaulay Culkin. And we've got that possible blocking behavior with the eyes closed for over a second.
What? Explain that blocking behavior. That's a good one too.
Psychological blocking behaviors. They found that children born blind, when they hear something they don't like, will either close their eyes, rub their eyes, or hold their hands over their eyes. So when people hear something they don't like, sometimes this will occur. Why could someone be uncomfortable that they have to close it? Now everyone blinks, but close that eyes for a full second or more. That's not something that occurs very often.
I like that. Did you notice at the very beginning? Can you go back a little quick? Because it's something that you said that I thought was real interesting. Go ahead, play it one more time.
Were you aware that Jordan Chandler or his family on his behalf filed a litigation, a lawsuit against you?
Yes.
The blink.
He had dead stare.
Yeah.
A dead stare, no blinks, during the entire duration of the question, which wasn't a long question, but there was no blinking. Yeah. And then he asks the question, and we see, again, just the slightest slouch down, uncomfortableness in the seat. But what about the blinking, Sean? I mean, is there any significance to that rapid blinking that just happened there?
Blink rates can be increased for several reasons. As we age, it starts to increase. The reason being is our eyes start to dry out. On top of that, stress, pain, discomfort, and sickness, and tired. And you're tired as well, your eyes will dry out. So all those things can cause it. So if you get a baseline behavior, sometimes people just be blinking because it's what they, you know, all those things. But he might have been asked a question that was stressful that he didn't like. He could also be in pain. I don't know why he'd be in pain. Maybe he's got to make a poop and he's sitting there and all of a sudden, well, who knows? But, you know, it's one of those things when it occurs, what was asked? And if we get on a topic and it starts to boom, 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 oh, that's pretty interesting. What point then does it stop again? And we'll look for when it starts and when it stops. And it's one of those things you're looking at so much, you know, as well as I do, you're interviewing somebody, you're focused, you're tired after you're interviewing somebody because you're focused in on what's being said, what you're going to ask. And then I'm paying attention, oh, blink rate's going on. And we could watch this video another five times. We'll probably pick up on another five things. But the thing is, you want to pick up as much as possible, right? Like, if I'm paying attention to your blink rate and I see your shoulders shrug, I'm like, okay, well, guess what? I might've missed what your feet were doing. And if I look at your foot, I might miss what your hands were doing. You know, it's just...
So with your training that you teach, and I will wrap it up, you know, I know we've been here for a while. You're basically teaching head to toe.
Yeah.
Do you have anything with respect to when you're talking to an individual? Because this I'm curious about too. Face to face with stance and feet.
Their stance or yours?
Theirs. I mean, a cop is
gonna stand
the way they stand.
Well, that's what I go over blading and different types of blading for aggression detection.
How does that work?
So there's a slight
like blade. something that when you all of a sudden, if I'm standing, and I know we may not catch this on video, if I'm standing here with you and mm-hmm. we're just having a nice general, you're talking to me, I'm the subject, you know, you're talking to me and I'm here, and then you know, all of a sudden I just start to like to turn, you know, and lean a little forward or backwards or, you know, looking like is there anything that's indicative of what could happen?
Well, if I come up on you and you're bladed, I'm gonna start moving around you to see if you're continue doing the do-si-do with me, right?
Okay.
You continuously blading. So there's three different types of blades I go over. One is the slight blade. It's what we do in an interview stance, right? One foot back, one shoulder back. And then there's a prominent blade. I'm like this now. I'm giving you my shoulder. There's a chance I got a weapon. I might gain proximal distance at the same time, get ready to draw something. On top of that, you got an enhanced blade. One hand inside a pocket, could be a jacket pocket, and the other hand's illustrating speech. Moving around, talking. Most people, if they talk with their hands, it'd be both hands. Now, people have limitations, disabilities. Maybe they're holding on to their keys. They lose all the time. Maybe it's just the way they do. However, if I move around you and you continue to do that and speak like this, and I have videos out there, you'll see this happens very often. Sometimes even with a prominent who approached the one cop in NYPD, got stabbed with a bottle. Like I think it was like a year ago. I don't know if you remember that one. Same thing. You come up, one hand's doing this, or it could be pacifying the person too. Like you're rubbing the face. Why, you see that, I'm going to treat that with the highest respect. I'm not going to be, that's interesting, just the hairs on the back of my neck. No, I might want to take cover, give commands. Because what's the first thing we do? Take your hand out of your pocket.
Bang. I was just going to ask you that. When you see something that's raising that minor indicators that could go from minor to major, what do you do in response to that besides your physical changing of your behavior of protecting yourself? Do you give verbal commands?
No, at that point you're not going to be, let me see, hey, turn around, put your hands on top of your head. And that's something, I'm not a defensive tactics instructor.
Sure.
So, and that's something you don't see every day. Think of all the people you approach. So there's a very good chance there's a weapon there. So I am not going to treat it like it, because that's something we don't see every day. And if you come across it, have a plan. Am I going to take cover and give commands? If I tell them to take, hey, am I going to grab their arm and say, listen, I want you to slowly remove? Well, that might not be the right answer either. You know, I'm going to wait till backup shows up. Well, maybe backup shows up and then they get freaked out and they pull the weapon out at that point. Oh, I think the best is to take cover, but that's also, I'm not your defensive tactics instructor, but it's something, have a plan. Because when you don't have a plan, that's where, you know, and every, everybody has a plan, things fall apart, but at least, hey, all right, I want to find cover now. I want to get behind this engine block of the cars here. I'm going to go back in the house. I'm going to give commands around the corner. I'm going to cut the pie. Hey, turn around, put your hands on top of your head. And maybe it doesn't turn out well if you do that, but if you stand there, you've higher the probability of things turning out worse. And what's the worst that's going to happen if they are holding on to the keys? You'll look like an idiot. Who cares? At least you go home safe.
That's the right. Right. That's the
at the end of the day.
I'm telling you, I think that there is so much value in what you're teaching for police officers. You know, if I was still on the job, I mean, I would be going to take your class in a heartbeat, without a doubt, because I feel that it's something that could save my life. I mean, I really, you know, if something could save your life, that's why we do training, is to become, as law enforcement, you take training to become better and proficient in something with respect to your career. The ultimate goal is to go home at night. I mean, you know, I'm still a little older than you, but I always go back and I, you know, when I have communications with somebody that's law enforcement, you know, through Street Cop or something, I always leave them with a saying that from an old show called Hill Street Blues, you know, listen, please always be safe. Yeah. Please always be safe. I mean, that's the most important thing. And if that means that day the bad guy got away from you, shit happens, you know? That's the way it goes. But if you're safe, that's the most important thing. So I could say that, you know, how highly I recommend for any law enforcement officer to go to your class. You know, my class, again, it's in a little bit of a different category. Not to minimize the importance of it, because I do teach law enforcement patrol officers, patrol officers, how to interview victims, how to interview witnesses, how to interview suspects, how to develop suspects, how to actually possibly get roadside admissions, what your interview could lead to with respect to if you do the interview the right way and you pick up on some indicators that it may lead to the next step of what could happen. And then ultimately, if you're ever tasked with sitting down and talking to a possible suspect, is having the tools to be able to get that person to tell you the truth legally, respectfully, and the right way, and be able to go to court and back it up, you know? Yeah. So I'm a believer that do it right or don't do it at all. And if it doesn't work out, that's the nature of our business. Sometimes it doesn't always work out to our favor.
Yeah, and I know you said you were like kind of minimizing your class, but that's something, interviews, everyone's interviewing all the time. And I understand you're going specifically for in the box, but everybody at some point, very likely to be in that position, number one. Number two, everybody you talk to. Everybody tells you you're interviewing. That's, and their skills, you're not taught those in the academy. You're just not.
No,
they had so many things they got to put forward that you're just not, oh, you're not taught
you.
Them.
You know? I agree with you, Sean. And, you know, like I said, one of the things that I really stress is that you as a patrol officer and a law enforcement officer, you are usually the first to respond to any call, regardless of what it may be, that requires a police response. And with that, you're tasked with having to talk to somebody and doing it right and doing it proper and being able to extract the right information is integral. And yes, that is, you know, that's why I teach. I have to tell people, listen, interview and interrogation is not just for detectives. You as a patrol officer, you could end up making cases that could lead to significant outcomes in investigations just by developing the information, by you being out there and doing it. So I, you know, again, I do minimize it a little bit because let me put it this way. Reality check on my behalf. I know it's not the most exciting topic in the world in law enforcement. I understand that. It's not the most exciting. Guys want to do, listen, we both know, remember the terms, and, you know, for any of our female officers listening, I'll just say there was a term called, when we all started this job, we were full of pee and vinegar. And that's what police officers want. I understand.
I loved it too, man. I loved that training of being able to go out and do that shit. But guess what? At some point in your careers, you might be tasked with talking to somebody. And if you don't know how to do it the right way.
But I still think it's a part of it. And I think that's what, you know, interdiction, you're interviewing people. I think it's a huge part of it. That's why I understand you using the word exciting, but I mean, and I get it. We found my interdiction classes when we first got on, but the same in drug classes, but this is part of it. If you don't want to talk to people, you ain't getting the drugs. You're coming in. I remember you first get on, you're like, how do I talk to people? You don't know. Cause you're like, when I talked to kid, when I was a kid talking to cops where I grew up, they came and they talked to you like you were a piece of shit.
Oh my God. Yes.
And you're just like, is that what they're supposed to do? You know? And you're like, this is weird. Like, am I not supposed, like you get on, you're like, well, that's not my personality. So like, how am I going to talk to people? Cause you were talked to like complete, any run in we have with cops where I grew up was pretty rough. The cops were, and they were known for that. And you dealt with them and you're like, man, and it was what it was. I don't know. You know, I'm like dancing around what I'm saying, but like
the nightstick was not far.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were just like, you know, if they showed up to a house party when you were like 17, drinking beers, you ran out of that house. Because you knew they'd be throwing kids around there.
Are you kidding me? They would love it. And then they would take all your beer and have a party.
Yeah, they called them hostages, I was told. They'd say, oh, we got the hostages. Literally, if you were drinking in the woods, you would come back later, you'd run, and then come back, they took the 30 packs.
All your beer was gone.
All the beer. Not that I was drinking underage or anything like that. But yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Right?
But no, it is. That's why I said, but it was when we decided that we were going to do this, how... these two topics definitely mesh together and intermingle together with respect to using one and using the other. And like you could use, I mean, what you're teaching to law enforcement and take that to the next step to bring it to where you might be doing a sit down interview with somebody.
Yeah.
Right. Just by what you've seen here that, well, wait a minute, something is not right. You know what? I remember Grogan's class with this. Let me see if I could take it a step further. And I'm a firm believer, and I teach this, is that you don't know unless you ask. Don't be afraid to make inquiries.
Yeah.
And sometimes those inquiries may lead to that behavior that you haven't been seeing. And you'll see, if you don't ask an uncomfortable question, you may not get an uncomfortable response.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I think it was Rob Ferrero, he brings up I've seen some of the class where he's like, you got to be able to ask those questions, you know, for interdiction, because you're asking uncomfortable questions. So he's like, someone says, because they're going to try to put you off. Yeah, I'm coming from we're traveling for a funeral. Oh, who died? You know, like, a lot of people will be like, oh, well, I don't want to get into your personal, but that's... You know, people do that to try to keep, my aunt. Oh, how old was she? You know, things like that where you're like,
yeah,
people could be uncomfortable, especially you're newer on the job. Like, well, I don't want to ask that. But this is the things you're going to ask to get that response. If they're making things up, they're like, oh, and then you ask the next person that's in the car, hey, how old was, where are you guys going? Whose funeral? And they're like, oh, it's my grandmother's. And wait, you guys are, how did that happen?
How did that
happen? What I mean?
I hope that the use of body cams, doesn't deter law enforcement from doing their job. Mm. I really hope it doesn't. I've heard, you know, a lot of times where people are like, well, now, you know, and I give the same answer. It's like, look, I get it, but do your job the right way as to the best of your abilities. And, you know, hopefully you won't ever have to concern yourself with it, that you were questioned about what you did. Believe in yourself. I mean, really, believe in yourself and that you're doing it right. And if you're not backed up by your administration, I don't have an answer for you on how to deal with that, other than you took this job to do what you're sworn to do.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah. I mean, we could, you said, Sean, we agreed that when we sat down, people will probably shut it off halfway through anyway. They'll probably be bored. But for you and I, this is never boring.
Yep. It's good. Thanks for doing this. It's great.
No, my police, thank you for doing it. I mean, I had a great time, and we could do this again multiple times. And I'm just going to tell everybody, his class is phenomenal. It could save your life. I mean, I'm not saying that lightly, Sean. Thanks. You know it. Your class could save your life if somebody picks up on something like that, you know? My class can help you. It may not save your life, but you could gain a lot of information from it, you know, the same way. But, you know, your class is, to me, is just extremely important.
All right, so you keep minimizing your class. There's things that people go pick up on to save their life as well.
Oh, I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to sit here and talk with you about this, my brother. Always, always. Thank you, Frankie.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.